Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and we are going to celebrate the 4th of July with a perfect guest. John Meacham is joining us this hour. I spent a good portion of the weekend going back to one of his books, which is one of my favorites, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, because he not only writes eloquently about the man who drafted the Declaration of Independence and was so instrumental in the founding of this country and was an extraordinary human being that it was worthwhile to read that. So we'll go way back to the summer of 1776 as we start our program today. John, of course, is a journalist and a historian. He is a scholar and a gentleman. He's written books on Thomas Jefferson. He has written all kinds of different books, and we've interviewed him on many of them. He wrote a great book on George Herbert Walker Bush, which is his most recent. He's currently working on a book about James and Dolly Madison. He's written about Churchill and Roosevelt. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his book on Andrew Jackson, and he's written many other books as well. And we're delighted to have him as our guest this hour as we celebrate the 4th of July, which is coming up tomorrow. And we'll be welcoming phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. John Meacham, hello. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I love that Thomas Jefferson book. I love everything you write, but I really like reading about him. It's really good to read about inspirational people.
It really is. I think it was James Parton, the 19th century biographer, who said that if Jefferson's right, America's right. If America's wrong, then Jefferson was right. Which is a heck of a burden to put on any one person. You don't hear that about Hamilton or Washington or Adams. But mm-hmm. I think that Jefferson's peculiar combination of philosophical insights and political ambition make him an incredibly resonant figure from age to age.
And the book has the quote from JFK I've always loved about Jefferson. He's got these Nobel Prize winners in the White House. And what does he say about Jefferson?
This is the largest gathering of talent and intellect and genius, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone, which is a generous remark from President Kennedy. Jefferson really, he embodies the best of us and the worst of us. He articulated the American creed of personal liberty, set us off on the right course, but excluded too many people from mm-hmm. that original definition. And I think that I think it was Everett Dirksen who said that at some point or another, every American has to get right with Jefferson. And I think that's a good way to put it, both in terms of what we've gotten right as a country, what we've gotten wrong, and what we still need to work on.
You write in the book, Jefferson, that there is no mistaking how significant Jefferson and his colleagues believed the scale of the American struggle to be. And then you ask this question, and I'm wondering how they answered it and what you think about this. It's a big question. Why did the colonists take such extreme steps, arming themselves, putting their lives and families at risk? Why?
They believed fundamentally that there had been a promise made to the English speaking peoples, ultimately, during the Glorious Revolution, during the period of 1688-89, 90 years before, in which they would be represented before things were asked of them. The taxation without representation, no taxation without representation. The creed of an Englishman's rights, which began with Magna Carta, rolls through the English Civil War, and then the Glorious Revolution when William and Mary come across. There's a Declaration of Rights, which we don't talk about very much. But remember, our forefathers were Englishmen first. And so their whole frame of reference, we're talking about rightly the 4th of July. They were talking about the English Civil War. They were talking about the showdown between King John and the nobles. They were talking about the Glorious Revolution. That was their frame of reference. And they believed fundamentally that they had been excluded from that promise of what an Englishman's rights were. And for a long time, they clung to the idea that it was just Parliament and the ministry, that the king was being manipulated. They were very late to break with the king, actually, in an emotional sense. And ultimately, in I think it was August of 1775, when the king declared that the colonists were now in a state of open rebellion, that was really pretty much the last straw. There was a little bit of pushback on the independence debates from John Dickinson, among others, leading up to what happened tomorrow. But basically, once the king was seen as having sided with London, broadly put, in suppressing, curtailing the rights of the Americans, that was the break.
Mm-hmm. It must have been such an alarming time. You walked down the streets and you probably weren't very sure about who was with you and who was against you, were you?
Exactly. The estimates are range in scholarly circles between 1 in 5 Americans were loyalists. Sometimes you hear a figure 1 in 4. Then there, of course, is a range of both loyalism and of revolutionaryism, if you will. You know, how passionate are you really? How many fair-weather soldiers, fair-weather Americans were there? And that was a big issue. This was functionally a civil war, which we don't think of it that way.
No.
But it was. And particularly in terms of combat in the South, which was brutal, more brutal in many ways than the Northeast, and so you're exactly right. It was a troubling, scary time, and it was a time the troubling nature and the scary nature of it continued past Yorktown, past the Treaty of Paris. I have an argument I make in the Jefferson book, and I'm making again now with the Madisons, that it's really impossible to understand early American history without seeing it not as the end of the French and Indian War in 1763 and then the beginning of the Revolutionary War and then the War of 1812, which is sort of the way we traditionally carve it up. I think you have to see it as a 50-year war, basically, which was sometimes hot, sometimes cold, sometimes ferocious, sometimes quiet. Sometimes against Britain, sometimes against France, particularly late in the 1790s. But, you know, we know how the story turned out. We know that ultimately the American cause triumphed. They didn't.
No.
They didn't know until 1815 when the Treaty of Ghent was signed and America had come through the test of the War of 1812 and managed to affirm its essential sovereignty. And at that point, really, things began, what we think of as the big, broad American growth of the 19th century begins at that point. That's when Henry Clay and the nationalist phase of John C. Calhoun and people like Daniel Webster and John Quincy Adams, that's when they start building the American system, where they worry about infrastructure and roads and a national tariff and a mm-hmm. national university. You didn't have all that prior to 1815. There was a psychic and political affirmation of the American cause that happened at the end of 1815, end of 1814, early 1815. And I think that to pay tribute, which I think we should, to that generation, we have to remember that at no point did they suddenly think, well, now we're going to put on our frock coats and have barbecue. You know, they were always, you know, feeling that they were at risk.
Yeah. What about the vision, though, of what we did become many years later? Did Thomas Jefferson have that vision of where we might be?
You know, I just had this debate with my good friend, the brilliant scholar Annette Gordon Reed, and we disagreed a little bit. I don't think he honestly could have envisioned what we became. On the one hand, in particular, it was really beyond the imaginative ken of almost every figure from that era to envision a racially integrated, ethnically diverse, market-based capitalist democracy. Now, people would argue that Alexander Hamilton saw that, but I think that's a little bit anachronistic. So the simple fact of our diversity and all being in one, on one continent, living together, however uneasily sometimes, is something that I don't think they could have foreseen. Mm-hmm. Jefferson did believe immensely in the idea of progress. He believed that the sun had come over the from the old world and was crossing the continent, and where it ends, where it sets, no one knows. You know, he did make big, bold gestures to try to create a future. Lewis and Clark, the Louisiana Purchase, very much wanted to become a continental force. But again, we know we are a continental force. It was much more likely in the late 1700s and the early 1800s that we were going to become something like Europe. With some several different nations, several different confederacies, if you will, which of course we almost did. And the idea that a republic of this size and this scope could survive and succeed this long was, I really think, beyond the hopes, within the dreams, and with, I guess, within the hopes, I should say, but beyond their sense of realism, and I think it doesn't take anything away from them to say that they couldn't envision exactly what we became.
Right. So there was a denunciation of slavery that Jefferson wrote in the Declaration, but it was eliminated. Can you talk about that?
It was. There was a Jefferson had three or four moments as a young man where he attempted to get on the right side of slavery. He did it in a legal case. He did it in the Declaration. He did it in the Virginia Assembly. And he lost each time. And as a political creature, he didn't like losing. And so pretty quickly he gave it up. But it was a denunciation of George supporting the slave trade. And one of the political problems with that in the Declaration was that that was a shot more at the North than at the South. That is, the people who profited most from the slave trade itself mm-hmm. were in New England mm-hmm. and some in the port cities of Charleston, but mostly in New England. And that, so it sort of had no constituency. The Southern delegates weren't interested in having slavery mentioned at all, and the Northern delegates, who might have been okay with a generic denunciation, saw that as a direct shot at them. And so it died in the editing session of the Continental Congress.
Hmm. All right, let's talk about these words, and many of them, including me and the friends I gather with tomorrow, always read the Declaration of Independence on the 4th of July. But the words are just, you know, they're really so carefully chosen and so meaningful. But I'm wondering how long it took for him to get to, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We all know those lines. What did he go through to come up with that?
I'm sorry to tell you, not a lot of sweat. he was a great deadline writer, you know, and there is a certain genius. T.S. Eliot made this point once. There's a certain kind of genius that only comes out under pressure. He had about 10 days to do this.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was a subcommittee. Let's see, it was Adams, Franklin, Jefferson, and I think Roger Sherman. Maybe Livingston from New York was on it. And Adams would have liked to have written it, but he thought that he was seen as too much of a radical. And Virginia being the largest colony, he thought that having a Virginian do it was a better idea. Jefferson had come to town, had come to Philadelphia with a reputation as a great writer. He'd written something called A Summary of the Rights of British America in 1774. Adams later regretted this because, as he put it, the Declaration was a theatrical show and Jefferson ran off with all the glory of it. Adams, being a lawyer, believed that the most important thing that had happened in that period was not the Declaration of Independence, but the order to the state governments to reorganize themselves as sovereign states, not as royalist governments. Mm. Only a lawyer could find that to be the great moment. But Jefferson adjourned to his house. There's a replica of it in Philadelphia now. Sat there. he probably had a lot of different things at hand. These were fairly common sentiments of the era. A lot of it came from John Locke. George Mason was busy writing something not dissimilar, had been in Virginia at the Declaration of Rights there. And one of the most interesting things he did was the Lockean formulation of this was life, liberty, and property, that those were considered the three great rights. Switching into the pursuit of happiness is a particularly interesting shift. And the idea of happiness in the late 18th century wasn't sort of we should all be cheerful and happy, though that was part of it. But it really was more of a civic Aristotelian idea that the individual happiness was inescapably and inextricably bound up with communal happiness, with civic virtue. It's a very Republican, lowercase r idea. And so the pursuit of excellence created a sense of happiness, a sense of give and take within a body politic. And I think it's one of the most felicitous phrases. And Jefferson left very little account of how it had come to him. But it was an idea in the thinking about Republican ideology that meant we weren't supposed to simply be single-minded about our own happiness. We had to think about the broader public as we pursued our course through life, because to jump ahead and borrow a phrase from Jack Kennedy, a rising tide lifted all boats.
And what about the phrase, John, that all men are created equal? What did that mean to Jefferson?
It meant that the idea of the divine right of kings or the hereditary rights of barons or landowners, titled nobles, that they were not created more equal than others. That to my mind, the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution itself is in many ways the political manifestation of the most important shift that happened in the Western world in the last 500 years, which is the idea that life was organized vertically from kings and popes and prelates and princes who, by either an accident of birth or an incident of election, had absolute power over others, that order was falling and that life had to be more organized more horizontally than vertically. So we are all created equal was a product of Gutenberg, the rise of the bourgeoisie, the Protestant reformations, the translation of sacred scripture into the vernacular, the entire idea that that there was a divine right, not simply for one class of people, but for all of us, that we were all born with the capacity and the impetus to make our own way. And so that we were all created equal was the cannon shot, the intellectual cannon shot that said the divine right of kings and of popes is gone. We have the right, we have the capacity to decide these things ourselves.
But particularly if we're white propertied men, right?
Totally. No. They were constrained by the prejudices and the short-sightedness of their era. The only way to continue to talk about them in a warm way is to realize that they were putting in motion a process, a long unfolding story that's taken too long to unfold, but which has in fact created a nation that, when we talk about our immigration problems, it's about too many people wanting to come in as opposed to too many people wanting to get out.
Yes. You must get invitations galore to 4th of July celebrations, do you? What a great guest you would be.
Well, tomorrow I will be riding in the Sewanee, Tennessee parade on a mobile cigar truck. So we probably don't want to go into the details of that.
John Meacham is our guest this hour. Scholar and a gentleman. He's written all kinds of books. The one he's writing right now is on James and Dolly Madison. For our particular purposes this hour, because we're celebrating America's birthday and talking about How We Became What We Became. I'm putting special emphasis on his great book on Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. He has written many, many books, though, about the latest one is on George Herbert Walker Bush. It's a fascinating book about him. It was on the bestseller list for a number of years, and he's written many other books as well on Andrew Jackson, book for which he won the Pulitzer Prize. He has written books about civil rights. He's written a wonderful book about Churchill and Roosevelt and many others. Welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. When you think about the summer of 1776, what do you think about? What do you think about the reasons for going to war? What do you think have been our shining moments over the last 241 years. Are we in trouble now? What are your thoughts about this country, about living here, about being an American? What are you proud of? What are you worried about? Who do you admire when you look at all of those who came before us, who helped create this country? We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network on the day before the 4th of July. John Meacham is here. We're celebrating America's birthday this hour with this wonderful historian and welcoming your phone calls. Mary in Madison is our first caller. Hello, Mary.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
I'm talking about Benjamin Franklin in England, and he was being rather shabbily treated by this one man. I don't know if it was at a hearing. And he said, he didn't say anything, and then he finally broke in, and he quietly said to his examiner, he said, I will make the king a very small king. And I was wondering if you could sketch out the background of this, and I'll listen off air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Mary.
I don't know that story in particular, but I can say that Franklin was a really our first great diplomat and was immensely popular, particularly in France and particularly with the ladies. He, to use a technical historical term, was quite good at hamming it up. He would wear coonskin caps and various sort of frontier wear that was not Philadelphia was not exactly the frontier, but he played this new American role quite brilliantly, and had been someone who really one of the first who had seen from the beginning where this drama was going. Very early on in the 1750s, he helped propose something called the Albany Plan of Union, which would ultimately have created Great America, part of basically a commonwealth of nations with not unlike Canada, New Zealand, Australia are today. So 20 years before the Declaration of Independence, Franklin understood where this big story was going.
I keep thinking, and maybe I'm overthinking this, but it seems to me as though there were a lot of people around in those years who were jacks of so many trades. You think about all that Ben Franklin did, all his inventions. You think about all that Thomas Jefferson knew about so many different subject matters. John Quincy Adams later. I mean, so many of them seemed to be able to do a whole lot of things. Am I overstating this, or were they kind of a special lot?
They were. It was an Enlightenment era. They were endlessly interested in lots of different things. Franklin was better at most of them than most, as was Jefferson. Madison was deeply interested in anatomy of all things. On the eve of the Constitutional Convention, he spent an enormous amount of time dissecting a weasel.
Oh my gosh! Did he really?
And wrote these endless letters about it. It's sort of gross, actually. But this was an era. Remember, to them, the experiment in government, the experiment in liberty, was not sort of political science, as we would later call it. It was part of the ambient reality of their time, which was the Enlightenment, which was right. The discovery that was Newton right? You know, was there harmony in the universe? And there was so much to learn. I mean, the scientific revolution had unfolded, and had begun to change how people thought. And without that intellectual scientific movement, it's hard to imagine the American Revolution taking shape as it did, because we were essentially the political zip code of that broad shift in how people thought, how they came to human knowledge, how they applied that knowledge.
Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Perfect program for the eve of the 4th of July. These days, I'm searching for hope, and I'm finding some in this program. My comment and question to the author is that you just use the phrase a special lot. And right now, I'm troubled because I find that in the executive branch of the government, from my perspective, maybe not from others, we have a special lot of people, and it worries me. But listening, I think if we got through the founding of the nation, as is being recited here, that probably there is reason to believe what the outgoing president, Barack Obama, said on welcoming the incoming president to the executive branch when he said after their private meeting, I think we are going to be all right. Because I've read biographies of Washington, and when he describes the army he was given, and they didn't have clothing or shoes. Mm-hmm. They didn't exactly know what lay ahead, but there was such tremendous trust among people that we could figure out how to make a nation together.
Hmm. Very nicely said, Rich. John?
No, I think that's exactly right. You know, St. Augustine once said, the best definition of a nation I've ever come across, it was in the City of God. He wrote that a nation is a multitude of rational beings united by the common objects of their love. A multitude of rational beings united by the common objects of their love. And America, more than most countries, has in fact been unified by a common object, a common assent, if you will, to an idea, to the idea of, however imperfect, equality. We're not a racially pure nation. We're not an ethnically pure nation. We're not religiously pure. We are devoted to an idea that all of us have a chance, all of us have the right and the opportunity to rise. And that's the great thing about America.
Let's go back to the army that George Washington had and to the thoughts in the minds of those who were fighting. Surely a lot of people must have thought, oh, I'm not sure we can win this thing, didn't they, John?
Oh, my Lord, yeah. I mean, you know, the fact that we won is little short of a miracle. And Washington actually spoke in those terms. He was not the most conventional of believers, but he did speak in miraculous terms. He was not a particularly successful military man coming into the Revolution. He, as the caller just rightly pointed out, he was given a not particularly professional army. Remember, a lot of these were militia folks. These were people who, you know, it wasn't as though you could call the Pentagon, you know, and say, hey, we're going to, you know, we need
an
army.
Right.
It was a guerrilla struggle. And as my friend Noah Feldman at Harvard Law School has pointed out, the United States really only the colonists really only began to win when it was shifted into a war of defense as opposed to offense, when it became a guerrilla struggle in which we could fight the invading army, and that was a key shift. But no, we it was a very close run thing, as Wellington said of Waterloo, and as I mentioned before, it continued to be a close run thing. You know, no empire wants to give up a continental piece of real estate that they weren't even sure how big it was, and a lot of them still thought it was the road to the Far East. So,
mm-hmm. Thanks, Rich, for your call. Happy Fourth, John in Middleton. Hello.
Hi, Jefferson said, I hope I recall correctly, don't ever let politicians elected officials control your land. To get away from land controlled by the nobles is why our parents left England. In my case, for example, I have a pear tree by a trailer. And politicians, elected officials, said, and I got cited for having a pear tree too close to a trailer on my land. And because I did not cut that pear tree down, I got cited and got fined, and I had to pay the fine. Now, that pear tree is on my land. Why should the politicians tell me what pear tree to cut because it's next to a trailer? And the trailer is not on the driveway.
Right.
It's off the driveway.
All right, John. Well, I bet you weren't expecting that call, John Meacham.
I have a lot of things to say not on that particular issue.
Right.
It sounds as though I'm with the caller. I wouldn't want to pay a fine either. The idea of freehold, ancient common law idea, is absolutely essential to the American experience, the agrarian experience. Jefferson's idea was that a nation of yeoman farmers who had their own standing, who had their own security, essentially meaning they could grow their own food if it came down to it, that they would be the units that would be the most stable parts of a republic. Hamilton had a competing vision, which was that the world was becoming ever more commercial, that in fact manufacturers and progress and a more industrialized world would create creating more wealth. Hamilton was right about that. I think we were lucky in the zone we were in to have both Hamilton and Jefferson fighting, because they represented extreme views, and the truth in that case was somewhere in between. And so, but I have great sympathy for all pear trees.
I do too, and I hope you planted another one, John.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the press for a moment. I'm interested in the press in 1776, and also I'm interested in this because of what's going on in 2017. Thomas Jefferson, when media lies to people, I will never, ever let them get away with it. But he also said, were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter.
Right. No president ever spoke more in needlepoint pillow terms than Thomas Jefferson. It's a wonderful aphorism. I'm sure when he said it, he believed it. One of the problems with Jefferson is he's so eloquent and so pithy in many ways we can use these things as tags that obscure the complexity of a given issue. But I think that he believed in the flow of information. He believed that without information, there would be no ability for a free government, a free people to continue and to thrive. And for him, though, a free press was not simply about neutral news. It wasn't even about that. It was about a partisan press, which is not unlike what we have now with certain cable networks that are more devoted to an ideological point of view than they are to a neutral news-gathering one.
Mm-hmm. And what about the press? How did people find out about the Declaration of Independence? How did the people in town know? How did it spread throughout the country?
It was printed and published and sent around, and it was read out loud in many ways. And so they were in a good position to have it because of the printing press, distributed widely.
We go next to Ron in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I'd like to point out, though Jefferson owned his own estate and had property, real estate, when he passed away 191 years ago tomorrow, same date John Adams passed away, the creditors descended upon Monticello. And droves, I guess. He had left a lot of unpaid debts. He had a problem living within his means.
John. Hello? Hello, John. Yeah, I think we lost. We lost the connection somehow. We'll try and reestablish that. John Meacham is our guest this hour. We agreed with Rich that he is a perfect guest for the 3rd of July, and we're delighted that he can be with us. We're spending a lot of time, because of the nature of tomorrow's holiday, the birth of America, on his book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, where he writes extensively about Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, and also about the Founding Fathers and the whole structuring of a brand new country in America. And welcoming your phone calls for him as well. John has written so many other books. He has a very deep understanding of the whole breadth of American history. His latest book that he's writing right now is on James and Dolly Madison. He's written wonderful books about, well, a number of people. George Herbert Walker Bush, that is his most recent book. He's written a Pulitzer Prize-winning book about Andrew Jackson. I want to be sure and ask him about Andrew Jackson as we continue, about Churchill and FDR and others. And if you would like to join us, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network. John Meacham is our guest, and I don't know if you had a chance to hear that last caller, John, but he was talking about the creditors who surrounded the estate because Thomas Jefferson... Oh, okay. We're still trying to reach him. Well, we can't get him at this point, so we're still... Oh, here we go. We'll get him here momentarily. So let me remind you, on this day before the 4th of July, we're asking you about what, you know, America means to you now. What about the founding? What questions do you have? John can literally answer so many of them because he's written about all of American history. I don't know if you heard that. We lost connection for a moment, but Ron was concerned about the creditors that Jefferson, when he died, owed a lot of people a lot of money, lived too well, beyond his means, John, or not?
Oh, he did. Oh, my Lord, yes. he would have loved Amazon Prime. He bought too many books and too much wine and was absolutely head over heels in debt. In many ways, you know, there was actually an interesting argument in scholarly circles about the more an American was in debt, the more patriotic they were, because they could cut off the English debts and start anew. I don't think that was the dispositive factor, but it certainly played some role. And in fact, Jefferson ended up having to auction off Monticello. They ended up selling Jefferson slaves in a way that destroyed the unit of Monticello after his death. Hmm.
Let's go next to Mike in Whitefish Bay. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Hi.
The part where Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence that they everybody's born equal with inalienable rights, some of that was from a friend of his in Italy named Filippo Mazzei. In their correspondence letters, Jefferson paraphrased and was inspired by some words to that effect that Filippo Mazzei had written. And I'm kind of curious as if you had also found that information in your research.
And Mike, who was Filippo? How did they know each other?
Filippo Mazzei was a friend of Thomas Jefferson in his travels, and they corresponded in writing.
Oh, John.
He had moved to... Albemarle County. Actually, Jefferson was wondering whether the Virginia soil would create great wine, and so he was also the person to whom Jefferson later wrote a very harsh letter about George Washington that was leaked to the newspapers and led to a break between Washington and Jefferson. I could be totally wrong, but and often am. I don't recall the I don't recall his role in the language of the Declaration. George Mason played a role. Let's say John Locke played a role. There had been a number of state declarations that were also made. Adams once remarked that there wasn't anything in the Declaration that had not been discussed in the Continental Congress in the previous couple of years. So it was... it was more of the ambient reality and ideology of the time. Jefferson himself said that he was not seeking originality of expression, but was wanted to create what he called an expression of the American mind, which is a wonderful idea. You know, and the idea that one could speak and express something like that seems awfully quaint to us in our own complicated time.
Mm. Maybe we need you to write us a new one.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mike, thanks for the call. Bill in Kenosha. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Enjoying your show. John, I've really enjoyed your writings, especially on Andrew Jackson. But I'm curious, which founding father would you like to have dinner with and why? I'll hang up and take the answer off.
Thanks, Bill.
No, that's a great question. It would be Jefferson because of the complexity of his character, because he could be transportingly eloquent about human liberty, and yet visitors to Monticello often reported being disconcerted by the fact that enslaved people within the house would be serving you dinner and would look exactly like Thomas Jefferson.
Hmm.
And they would be startled by the physical appearance.
Mm-hmm.
He was creating this biracial society there, even though he didn't think there could be a broader biracial society in the United States. So it would be a difficult dinner because I would want to ask about how is it exactly that you were able to go as far as you were in terms of courage, in terms of taking a risk, risking your life. He would have been probably executed had he been captured when the British invaded Virginia when he was governor, but he escaped. You're willing to risk everything, but you stop on the question, the most intimate question of human liberty, which was your own convenience, your own life was made possible by slavery, and you knew it was wrong morally,
yes,
but you were not willing to make the ultimate sacrifice.
Mm. That is such a tough one, isn't it? It's just so hard. And we've struggled for so long. You wish they could have made some major decision on all of that, and everybody agreed on the slavery issue back in the 1770s. But it keeps going on and on and on, and the price we've paid for this.
Oh, my Lord. You know, and I often say when people say, oh, well, when people either want to put the entire Indian removal question on Jackson or the entire question of African-American slavery on Jefferson, you know, they may have been on the extreme edge of the mainstream, but they were within the mainstream of mm-hmm. their time. And I think being, as Arthur Schlesinger used to say, being self-righteous in retrospect is easy, also cheap. You know, it took the deaths of casualty figures move historically, but more than 600,000 Americans in the cataclysm of the Civil War to finally adjudicate slavery. And so to expect one person to have liberated the nation, so to speak, from that struggle seems a bit much to expect.
Right. Bill is next in Kewaunee. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Real quick question. My understanding is that the original Declaration, handwritten by Jefferson, has been lost or doesn't exist. If that's true, what do you think happened to it?
Oh, that's a great question. We have his edited versions. Now, whether there was an original one or not that was lost, I'm not sure. But you can see where he made changes along the way. So I think the National Archives has all that. I'm sure it's available online. The good thing about Jefferson is his handwriting is very neat. He was a very tidy, precise, almost fussy writer. So it's something that you can follow along.
Thanks, Bill. We go to Mitch in Mount Horeb. Hi, Mitch.
Hi. Thanks for punching me in here. Great show so far. So my question was, with Thomas Jefferson's idea of democracy and when he wrote the Declaration, and then how that's progressed to our current state, which is arguably not a democracy. Harvard study shows that we have kind of turned into a monopolistic oligarchy in the political sense. And I was just curious what your thoughts are of, you know, what he would think of that current state, or, you know, maybe what we can do to get back to what the original idea was of democracy.
All right. Well, there's a big question for you. America in 2017, John.
It is a big question. First, you know, the founders were not really creating a democracy. That's one thing to begin with. They were creating a republic. They, in fact, feared democracy. They feared the popular vote. Senators were to be elected by state legislators. The Electoral College was to be a buffer between the popular vote. The Senate was to be the place where they would check the impulses of the House, which was by design closer to that of the people. So it really took until the age of Jackson in the 1830s before democracy moved from being almost a dirty word to being a more popular one. Are we a monopolistic oligarchy? It's unquestionable that the levels of economic inequality are having deleterious political effects. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I'm a hopeful guy ultimately. It seems to me that Winston Churchill was right, that you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing once we've exhausted every other possibility. and so I tend to think that if we can intelligently focus on increasing equality of opportunity, not of outcome, but of opportunity, if we can make education more broadly available, if we can give people a chance to rise or fall on their own merits as opposed to the circumstances of their birth or the economic circumstances of their origin, then we will be headed back on the right path. We were on the right path in the post-World War II era, but it was driven by an immense prosperity unlike the world's ever known. And that was the era of the GI Bill. It was the era where, as difficult as it was, the civil rights movement managed to come out of this era of prosperity because people began to see that if you had a chance, everybody should have a chance. And that's the kind of spirit, that's the kind of habit of mind and heart that I hope we can recover.
And James and Dolly Madison are next. Because why, John?
Immensely important people in the founding and creation of our political culture, and I don't think they're fully appreciated as human beings. Madison was a critical figure from the 1770s into the 1830s. Dolly Madison was the most important woman, arguably, in broad political America for at least 20 years. And so I want to give us all a sense of what it was like to live in a capital over which they ruled and to examine what they got right and what they got wrong.
Yeah. Well, I can't think of anybody better for us to spend the day before the 4th of July. Isn't it great you know all of this? I mean, you must think
of
it.
Yeah, it makes me very annoying, I promise.
No, it doesn't at all. It makes you a very welcome guest. Thanks, John, so much for being
with us.
Thanks
so much. All the best.
Yeah, same to you. John Meacham, our guest, now working on a book on James and Dolly Madison. His latest book is a very good one. I read all of it, actually, the book on President George Herbert Walker Bush. We won't be with you tomorrow because it's the 4th of July. We will have a tape and Capitol Steps. Wanted to end this show with one of my favorite arrangements of this song, which should be our national anthem, don't you think? Thanks very much to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour, and to Colleen as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee.
America. God done shed his grace on thee. He crowned thy good. Yes, he did.